We were at the point where Colonel Blair had declared that the Mount Sanford rescue attempt for the military aircraft had been abandoned. And I said, Colonel Blair, we've got a hand in town here that's a rope artist, and he's a tremendous talent on rescue, and for some time he's been the only guide in the Mount McKinley National Park system, and his name was Janae. And he said, oh yes, I know of Janae. I heard of him on some of his guided tours. Where do we get a hold of him? Well, I said, he lives locally in a tent out in the brush here. Let's see if we can find him. So we contacted Janae, and Janae said, sure, he'd get his hardware together and an anchor man. For his anchor man, he chose Dave Johnson, a member of the 1967 January winter climb, which was the subject of a book, 148 below zero, I don't know the exact numbers in paperback and hardback, but it was probably a bestseller. The book 148 Below, which involved Janae on the winter climb, as I say, of McKinley. At any rate, Janae agreed to take his anchor man, Johnson, and they were airlifted to the 13,000 foot level. They climbed down a rope ladder off the bucking helicopter in a turbulent wind to the near the top of Mount Sanford. They got all their gear there, and no sooner had the helicopter departed than the tremendous winds began to batter the Wrangell Mountains and Mount Sanford in particular. So for 7 days, they were unable to start a fire. They had dug an ice cave with their axes, but the howling gale covered them up with fine snow, and it made it impossible to start any Prima stove to melt any water or to cook any food. So at the end of the 7 day period, the storm raged and finally blew itself out, and they were in radio contact with the military, and they told the military to come on and get them, because during this period of 7 days, they hadn't been able to get out of the ice cave but to set 100 yards of fixed line. And their sleeping bags were solid ice, and they weighed about 100 pounds apiece. And furthermore, they needed some hot food to eat. So the helicopter came in, and the winds were down, and they airlifted Janae and Johnson, the anchor man, to a two-day recovery over at the Glen Allen area. And then at that point, the anchor man, Johnson's wife, declared that she was on her way to the hospital to have an increase in their family, and she didn't think it was proper for him to risk his life on top of Mount Sanford again. The idea was to go back. So this shot down the plans, and Janae was in search for another anchor man. At this particular time, within matter of hours, I got a call from a captain of Pan American Airlines. His name was Rex Post, senior captain of Pan American Airlines, a tremendous athlete, a professional photographer in his spare time, and a mountaineer in his spare time. Now, Rex Post was an outstanding athlete and a fine, sociable type, and the previous year, he had climbed with Janae and successfully topped out McKinley, which had been his lifelong ambition. Also, he'd spent considerable time in the Alaska Range over in the Farewell Post River area, photographing mountain sheep and other wild game of that area. So I was surprised to hear from Rex Post in Seattle. He said his run was to Europe on the alternate four-day schedules. He would go to Europe on one schedule, and then he'd fly over into the Orient on the next schedule in a new 747 aircraft, of which he was senior captain. So, he says, is there anything going on? And I says, you bet. I said, Janae's looking for an anchor man. I explained the wreckage of the military aircraft on Sanford. And he says, good. He says, I'll switch off a shift to Japan. I'll offload at Anchorage, and I'll be up there tomorrow. So he made all the arrangements with Pan American, and being a senior captain, pulled it off rather neatly. Got all his climbing gear, met Janae in Anchorage, and the following morning, at an early hour, they were landed on the 13,000 foot level, or rather 13,200 foot level, where they offloaded from this helicopter. And their objective, of course, was about 900 feet almost vertically on a shelf directly over their head, up near the very top of Sanford. Well, Rex Post, with his fine record and his establishment in Pan American as a senior pilot, had no problem with the Army on clearances. His record of performance as a mountaineer made him a natural, it seemed, to help Janae get into the wreckage of the military aircraft. As soon as the helicopter left, the proverbial storms crashed into the wrangles again. The high winds began to blow, and the temperature dropped, and it had all the variations of ice storms and battering of the elements. And this went on until the next morning, when it subsided slightly, and Captain Rex Post and Janae began to set steel pitons and ice pitons and work their way towards the wreckage of the military aircraft on the top of Sanford. Well, all during this time, Captain Post was having a ball, or rather appeared to be having a ball. He was quite jovial. But Janae said he started to slow down, and he noticed that he was breathing very hard. Of course, you're at nearly 14,000 feet, and at that altitude, you have not quite slightly over the half the Earth's atmosphere. 60% of the Earth's atmosphere is below 14,000 feet. Half of the Earth's atmosphere is at about the 17,000 foot level. At any rate, it's a high altitude operation, but Janae paid no attention, and all of a sudden he noticed Captain Post developed a cough, and then Post slowed down considerably, and Janae asked him how he felt, and he bannered back and forth, and finally he allowed that he didn't feel too well. So Janae put him in his sleeping bag and Janae's sleeping bag, and within 2 hours, Captain Rex Post of Pan American Airlines died of pulmonary edema. That's pneumonia at altitude, where the strange process takes place. That is, the plasma of the blood filters to within the lung cavities, and you practically drowned in your own fluid. A terrible way to go. At any rate, by this time, it was middle of the night, and a black night it was, overcast at 20,000 feet, and Janae got a message to the Army to send the helicopter right in, because Rex Post had died of pulmonary edema on the rescue mission, and the Army made all haste, and they did bring in a helicopter, and they did remove Captain Rex Post and Janae from the 13,200 foot level, and then the terrible storms once again closed in, and the Wrangell Mountains were obscured for another week or so. 10 days later, Janae made up his mind, but he had to fight the general and the chief brass of the military. He said, and he looked around, and there was no one for an anchor man no one to help Janae. So he said, I'll do it alone. So he approached the military and they said, this is extremely hazardous, too dangerous, and we won't take you in. So after an argument that involved about 2 days with the military, they finally agreed to take Janae in alone. So once again, the helicopter roared into the summit of Mount Sanford. Janae offloaded down the rope ladder, complete with his gear. And this time, something was different. The weather smiled, and the winds were calm. There was no more violent storms. And Janae successfully set his rockinized pitons in fixed line and hurriedly made his way and did get to the wreckage. And he tore the wreckage apart and discovered that all crew members aboard had died on impact. But he recovered personal belongings, took pictures of the engine instruments and other classified objects that the military needed, and returned to the 13,200 foot level and once more called for the helicopter. Fortunately, the helicopter was able to come in on the remaining tail end of the good weather, remove Janae, complete with all the information the military had seeked out, and returned to Elmendorf. At any rate, in recognition of Janae's endurance contest, they offered him a position as a cold weather test expert. And since that time, he has guided more than a dozen military cold weather test expeditions to the areas of high altitude glaciers of McKinley. And he's also retained at the pay rate of a colonel, which takes the slack out of the lean mountaineering monetary winter problem for Janae. Now, let us switch to a different type of a plot. Let us talk about the north coast of Alaska. A beautiful sight from Point Barrow, southbound in the month of May, when the short sunlight strikes the ice fields, one can see marine life. There's thousands of seals. There's five varieties of seals. There's the ring seal, the spotted seal, the hare seal, the fur seal, and the ugaruk, which is a variety of mammoth seal, sometimes weighing a ton or more. And the North Chukchi Sea in the Point Barrow area, extending on down towards Nome and Kotzebue, is a vast and shallow continental shelf area, and it harbors a tremendous amount of shellfish and other types of fish that live in this very shallow and lucrative area, the lucrative feed area. So also in the leads of the ice, which you can readily see, the breaks of the ice, the open ice of the Chukchi and the Arctic Ocean, you often see whales of various types through the open, broken ice leads. Now, there's also in this area a lot of other wildlife. There's a polar bear population that extends to the Greenland ice cap and over into Norway. Now, the polar bear is a very intelligent animal, and he roams the polar ice cap in search of day-to-day food, and he's quite clannish. Now, the seals, it said, can hold their breath for 19 minutes and 30 seconds underwater while they fish for crustaceans and candlefish. Now, candlefish, you see, is also known on the coast as a tom cod, but popularly known as a candlefish because you can eat this fish fresh, frozen, or cooked. Also, you can stuff the fish's head in a beer bottle, and light his tail, and he will furnish light like a candle. Quite a utility fish. There's other varieties of fish that that feed in the kelp beds and on the crustaceans and the other fishes of the far north. Now, there's, as I mentioned, thousands of various varieties of seals. Now, these seals fish for the fishes under the ice, and once in approximately every 20 minutes, they must find a bubble of air underneath the ice or a saw hole through the green ice. Now, the green ice is formed between the ancient ice packs, which could be 100 feet thick. As the ice pack shifts, and at 30, 40 below zero, with a cold wind, there's new ice forms. This is known as green ice. This is where you do not want to land while polar bear hunting. You must land on an ancient ice pack with pieces of suitable length so that the aircraft can effect a successful loaded takeoff. But primarily, you must not land on the green ice because since it is shifting and since it is new, your chances of falling into the bottom of the ocean are quite great. So we eliminate the probability of landing on green ice. This is the first thing you learn up on the north coast. Now, on with this story of the Cagey, the canny polar bear, who realizes that once every 20 minutes, the seal must find either a bubble of air beneath the ice to breathe or saw himself a hole through the green ice and poke his head out into the sunlight for several breaths of fresh air. Now, the sun shines from the southeast, and in the beautiful days of May, March, beginning from possibly late February, the sun casts long shadows to the northwest. And another important thing about a polar bear is that they're all left-handed. The manner in which the seal saws a hole through the ice to get this breath of air is very interesting. We've said that the reason that the seal's under the ice is because he's been fishing. He's been eating freshwater, rather saltwater shrimps, various crustaceans, candlefish, sheathfish, and the various types of fishes that live in the North Sea. So, the seal rolls over on his back. He uses his sharp claws like a buzzsaw. And in short order, he can saw his way like a buzzsaw through more than a foot of ice to get that breath of air. Well, this polar bear is familiar with the habits of the seal. The seal is the main food of the polar bear. So he's developed seal hunting to a fine science. Now, the seal is not necessarily an ignorant animal in itself. To survive, you have to be aware. The seal is aware. If the polar bear approached the hole from the south-southeast, he would cast a shadow over the fresh hole that the seal is just sawing through the ice, the green ice. So, being a very cagey animal, a polar bear approaches from the northwest on the down shadow side of the hole. And there's a discrepancy on accuracy at this point. Always with his left paw, the polar bear covers up his mouth as he approaches from the northwest. Now, as some people say, this is to cover up his black nose, because if the seal poked his head out of the ice hole, saw the black nose. Black means trouble in the Arctic. He would immediately submerge. But then some people say that, no, the nose is not too important. It's his flashing white teeth and pink tongue that would frighten the seal. At any rate, as the seal saws his way through the ice, he puts a fine spray of ice chips in the air. The bear is positioned on the downside of this buzzsaw operation as he sees the flying particles of ice come from the bottom of the surface up through the green ice to the top, and he literally knocks the seal right out of the ice hole. In one tremendous left hook, the seal is out of the ice, and Mr. Polar Bear proceeds with his lunch. Let me say that many world hunters have visited the north coast of Alaska to acquire a polar bear. There's two ways to hunt a polar bear. As of late, the state has discontinued the use of aircraft, which in itself was very destructive to the polar bear, the beautiful animals of the North Coast. It is now legal to hunt via dog team, which is the way as it should have been. On a dog team, with the dog team, a client usually takes his chances. These chances are manifold. For instance, the wind is a tremendous factor in the whole Arctic. If the wind blows from the northeast, it indicates a high pressure area and fair weather. If the wind blows from the southwest, it indicates near disaster, because it will undoubtedly move. The ice flows, great leads 80 or 100 miles wide will open up, and with a driving gale from the southeast, if a dog team and a driver and a client is caught out in the open leads or in the once frozen area, the south wind will invariably open tremendous leads, and the dog team, the clients, and the dog team driver will have problems making a landfall. At any rate, with aircraft as opposed to dog teams, the usual objective was to pick out a suitable day when you could read tracks, hopefully on fresh tracking snow, and very shortly out of one of the places from Shishmaref, Kotzebue, Point Hope, Wainwright, or Barrow, you could, within several hours, track maybe half a dozen polar bears, land, clobber the polar bear, and the hunter, the great white polar bear hunter, would be on his way in 4 or 5 hours with a 10-foot polar bear. As I mentioned, the state has made illegal the use of aircraft, and this was a good move because aircraft just take too much advantage of the polar bears. I will lightly mention my last polar bear hunt from Point Hope in 1960. I had four clients. One was a senator, state senator from Oklahoma. Senator Baker, spelled B-O-E-C-H-E-R, state senator. He reformulated all the game regulations of Oklahoma and ran a telephone exchange in his spare time, and was quite a luminary figure and still is in Oklahoma. Howard Driggs, who runs a considerable dairy operation in Palmyra, Michigan, and his two sons, the four clients. I asked one of the sons, I says, tell me about your dairy. The son said, well, we have a dairy. I said, yeah, I know. How big a dairy? Well, the second son says, we have 100 trucks. I said, 100 trucks to haul milk in? And the son said, yes, and the old man piped up and he says, yeah, and we got 300 miles of stainless steel pipe. So at this point, I imagine the pipe, the stainless steel conduit, was to pipe in the milk to the plants, the central plant for processing for the market. So I thought I would catch the old man, and I said, hey, you've got 200 trucks, you've got 300 miles of stainless steel 6-inch conduit. Tell me, I was raised on a farm. How do you propose to wash this 300 miles of steel stainless conduit? He says, no sweat. We just pour the steam through there when we get the milk through. So at any rate, we're all at Point Hope. One tremendous southeaster blows in. Prior to this time, we had been on a two-day hunt, had netted 1 9-foot polar bear, a fine specimen, for one of the lads, one of Professor Driggs's boys, had got a 9-foot polar bear. But in view of the southeast winds and in view of my acquaintance with the North Coast, I abandoned the hunt for the particular day when the storm hit. And we sat in an old dugout Quonset hut and endeavored to play poker all day and all night and all the next day. And the storm blew, and about 3 o'clock the following morning there was one tremendous crash. And always you fly with a second plane up in the Arctic, so if you knock off a gear, the second plane knows your location, can give you a hand. Also on skinning out polar bears, you can make the job a lot faster if you double up on the bear and get out of there before the shifting ice breaks underneath the airplane or between the airplanes or any other disaster strikes. It's been a good management to have two aircraft. So a half Eskimo named Wheeler was flying Floyd Wheeler, the second aircraft, and he was my old friend, and he lived in Kotzebue for years. He's a mechanic for the FAA, present FAA, old CAA, and I'd sold him an airplane, and he thought it was the best bargain of his life, so he wanted to fly cover on this particular hunt in 1960. So this leaves the five of us playing in this big poker game all day and all night when this tremendous crash occurred. And Wheeler says, ho, ho, he says, that was your airplane. And I say, no, Wheeler. We had the planes tied down to frozen whale ribs in the ice and behind these sod buildings at Point Hope. They have walls 5 feet thick, and they're just the best type of structure in a heavy wind. At any rate, I say, no, Wheeler, that was your airplane. And he looked kind of odd, and he said, I go look. So, unable to get out of this old buried Quonset hut we was in, we discovered the problem. The alleyway had been struck by a flying doghouse in a gale force wind, which was blowing so hard it was blowing full barrels of diesel oil up and down the beach. Anything that moved got blown away. They never tie a dog to the doghouse on the North Coast because he would be beat to death as the wind blew the doghouse away. Also, there's some fringe benefits to doghouses. It's a long ways to fresh water, and I have never done it, but I've heard tell where sometimes they get the doghouse ice mixed and confused with the other area ice, and they make tea out of it. However, the poker game continued. It was impossible to sleep because of battering and the raging of the storm, but finally, 3 days later, the storm abetted, and the hunt continued. So, first hunter on the lineup was Senator Baker. So Senator Baker's telephone company had presented him with a Weatherby special handmade gun with inlaid stock and his name and various scroll work on it, and this was one of his gunsmith friends, since the senator was a wing shot, had honed down the trigger to where it was probably an eighth of a pound trigger pull. And I'd noticed this on target shooting, that it was a touch trigger. And also noticed something else about this Weatherby. Instead of holding one in the barrel and three in the magazine, three cartridges that is, I noticed that it only held two in the magazine and one in the barrel. Well, I mentioned this to the senator, and he said, yeah, he couldn't understand it. So it was overlooked, this small set of details were overlooked, and as we climbed into this plane, he said, says, I just remembered something. I put a cartridge in the barrel of this Weatherby by accident. I say, oh, better put it on safe because you've got about an eighth of a pound trigger pull. Senator was sitting in the plane. He says, what'll I do? Well, I said, put the safety on. So he maneuvered the gun to put the safety on. The gun went off with a tremendous blast. We're both inside of the plane. The door, hopefully, is, luckily, is open. And it nearly shattered our eardrums. And he says, uh-oh, I've shot my left foot off. And for this special occasion of Senator Baker and the Driggs and his sons, I had thought ahead 6 months and had four pairs of sealskin mukluks made especially for them, and another pair for myself. And these are waterproof, and they allow Five, four, three, two, one. This is Talkeetna, and we're about to relate some tales of a rescue, possibly a North Coast story in the Point Hope, Point Barrow area, and maybe a humorous mountaineering type story. And there's many interesting activities in the high altitude mountains, that is the Alaska Range and the Wrangell Mountains, and unbeknown to the public for a period of 22 years, there's been Arctic Institute of Arctic Biology, cold weather tests for the Air Force and the Ordnance Department of the Army, testing various types of cold weather gear, and also from 1951 through 1959, I had the pleasure of airlifting Dr. Bradford Washburn's original survey of the Alaska Range. Now this involved great many landings in locations on high altitude glaciers that no one had ever landed on before. During August of 1950, I was contacted by Dr. Bradford Washburn, director of Boston Museum of Science. In cooperation, he was granted the funds from National Geographic and other mapping sources to map the great massif of Mount McKinley, the tallest mountain on the North American continent. He had flown with Dr. Terrace Moore, who was president of the University of Alaska, through 1950. Dr. Terrace Moore was recalled to the Atomic Energy Commission for his talents in numbers and his knowledge of that field. And so it remained for Dr. Washburn to find someone that was willing to tackle some of these high-altitude glaciers to continue and to start with the levels from the base, the very sea level levels from the base of the Mount McKinley area, and carry these levels to the various peaks and to map precisely all elevations of the peaks of the Alaska Range, mainly the Mount McKinley, the Mount Hunter, and the Mount Foraker area. And presently, in 1960, a tremendous map with 200 foot contours was printed, edited in Switzerland, most accurate map in the world, and it stands as a finished product of the 9 years of Dr. Washburn's survey of the Alaska Range. Now, when Dr. Washburn first mentioned that he needed an airlift to these remote, inaccessible places in the Alaska Range, he added quite a bit of bait to the proposition. He said that if I were willing to land in an area of his choosing, I could pick the spot at the rate of $100 a landing. At that time, we had 8 aircraft lined up in Talkeetna, most of them with but a down payment on the total value of the aircraft. So I was overjoyed with the thought that here was a big opportunity to pay off these 8 aircraft. Landing on the glaciers throughout the summer requires the innovation of retractable skis. Fortunately, I was able to get the number 2 serial number from Federal Ski Corporation of the new retractable skis. This I had on my aircraft in 1949. This was one of the drawing cards, since these were a very scarce item. That is the retractable ski, which made the utilization of the aircraft in the summertime for the glacier fields, and also you could retract the skis and land on the bare gravel or pavement in other areas. So at any rate, in the beginning of the spring of 1951, we started from the base level of Mount McKinley and continued with U.S. Geological Survey levels to all high points of the Alaska Range. And about this time, the mountaineers of the world, of Europe and of the East, found and heard that there was an access to the inaccessible high-altitude glaciers. And in addition to the survey crews, I was besieged by great numbers of international climbing expeditions. I'll mention a few of the most important. One of the most outstanding was Riccardo Cassin from Lecco, Italy. And he had a great story in his background. He was a very wealthy Italiano industrialist, and he is a maker of the finest ski equipment and outdoor gear in all of Europe. He had a wager with a companion industrialist of Italy, and the wager was of a considerable sum of money, that never having seen the south face of McKinley, Riccardo Cassin could, with his crew of 9 professional rope artists, tremendous athletes of his choosing, could climb the south face of McKinley. So they were well equipped. Now in Europe, they climb differently than in Alaska. In Alaska, you have the tremendous chill factors of high altitude. This is not necessarily true in Europe. In Europe, for instance, climbing shoes and rock climbing and ice climbing foot gear is designed to protect your ankles and your feet, not necessarily for warmth. Now, this is one of the key problems of Ricardo Cassin. They climbed to the 16,200 foot level under marginal weather conditions. At this point, all nine Olympic class athletes and the great rope artists of Italy with Ricardo Cassin were at the 16,200 foot level of the south face of McKinley, an extremely formidable place, thousands of feet straight up and down. Many mountaineers of international fame had looked upon the south face of McKinley, and they counted it as an impossibility. However, Ricardo Cassin, as I say, and his whole team were caught in a tremendous storm, which lasted 3 days and three nights at the 16,200 foot level. Now, you must remember that the wager was a considerable fortune that Ricardo could successfully climb the south face of McKinley. Here he was at 16,000 feet, trapped in a tremendous storm. The high velocity winds screamed by like locomotives going in opposite directions. The chill factor was probably 50, 60 below zero, in spite of the fact this was in the month of May. The winds battered the Mount McKinley range, and finally it cleared. As I say, Ricardo would not go down, and he could not go up. That was 3 days and three nights. They hung on their ropes, pitoned to the sheer face of the south face of McKinley, and they froze their feet and their hands and their faces. When the weather did clear, I must explain at this point that a frozen hand or foot or any extremity is like a second or a third degree burn, extremely excruciatingly painful, and the hand or the limb swells and becomes lacerated, and within a short time turns black, and gangrene poisoning sets in because of the circulation to the extremity being disrupted or shut off completely. At any rate, they continued to climb in their horrible conditions, and with superhuman effort were the first to climb the south face of McKinley. Now, furthermore, they set all their pitons, their rock and their ice fixtures and their ropes, and luckily negotiated the trip down the same route, the south face, that they had gone up without a fatal fall, which is pure amazement in itself. At any rate, I closely watched the progress and was aware of, due to their slow progress, that they were probably having trouble with frozen hands especially. And I picked the whole nine up at about the 10,200 foot level as they came down the ropes off the south face of McKinley. And this was the first climb of Mount McKinley. They call the south face route the Cassin route, C-A-S-S-I-N. There are many tales of many adventurers who met an ultimate challenge with no success. Let me mention one. During the summer, month of June, 1971, one of the world's great leaders in outdoor recreational and climbing activities, and a team of 35 members of the Outdoor Leadership Program climbed or started to climb the northeast approach approach of McKinley via the Muldrow Glacier route. And at the 10,000 foot level, they had a tremendous accident. Bouillard, a world famous pathologist, was leader of the 35-man expedition. My job was to drop 5,000 pounds of supplies and fuel at the 10,300 foot level at the base of the Harper's Icefall. During a period of 3 days, I was just wrapping up the 5,000 pound airdrop. Actually, the packages are in increments of about 40 pounds, and I make precision airdrops and hopefully pile all of the gear in a very small area of, say, 400 or 500 feet for a simple recovery. At any rate, on one of my finishing airdrop runs, I noticed at the 10,100 foot level the scene of a tremendous accident of some kind. This is in the breaks of the Harper's Glacier. That is the very source of the Muldrow Glacier, the upper reaches of the Muldrow Glacier, which is very crevassed. There's one ice bridge adjacent to another for a period, a distance of a mile and a half or more. And it was over this ice bridge field that the accident occurred. In the center of the field was a pressure ridge. Dr. Bouillard, the world-famous pathologist who was leading the 35-man expedition, had just put in a tremendous shift with his big crew, and they were all roped together in mountaineer fashion, and he declared that they would pitch camp at the 10,001 elevation on a pressure ridge, and they would at that point shed their packs and then continue to the 10,200 foot elevation, which was a lateral distance of a quarter of a mile up the Harper's Icefall base, and they would begin the recovery of the airdrop material. When setting up a tent, you normally, in a dangerous place, stay roped up. The mistake was that Dr. Bouillard, after wearing his rope harness for about 12 hours, he had moved, of course, over this very treacherous ice fall to his present camping location, he decided that he would take off his harness. As you move with a heavy pack and a rope harness, why, you sometimes become sore in various places, so he elected to take off his harness. No sooner had he taken off the harness, he punched through an ice bridge and he fell 140 feet and landed right on his head in the bottom of a closing crevasse. Well, as I came by with one of the last parts, one of the last loads of the airdrop, the supply airdrop, there was a terrible commotion. There were various team members in various configurations, and it was apparent that there'd been a serious accident. I could see the hole as I flew by. I didn't know how many people were lost in the fall. Fortunately, only Dr. Bouillard, the leader. But it took about 10 hours to recover Dr. Bouillard, and he was dead on impact, of course. He was a very large man, about 6'4". He weighed about 235, quite large for a mountaineer. And so immediately the crew stamped out a sign for me to read, and it said land. But it would have been impossible to even land a helicopter on those ice bridges. Looking down, I could see the contours of the various deep moraines, the crevasses, and the broken ice, which was thinly veiled by about a 6-foot crusted cover of snow which had been wind-blown and drifted. And this is exactly the kind of a trap that was fatal to Dr. Bouillard. All these horrible crevasses covered with wind-blown drifted snow, and in spite of his knowledge of glaciers, he failed to do the right thing at the right time, which was to stay roped up. At any rate, I didn't land. It was impossible to land, so I dropped a note. I told the expedition members to sled the victim. At a later time, I came by and saw there was but one victim. Sled the victim down glacier to the 8,200 foot level of the Muldrow Glacier, where I might recover him with a fixed wing aircraft. Now, Dr. Bouillard, as I mentioned, was a world famous pathologist from the Indiana State University, and there's a tremendous press to recover his body. There was a night and day wires, telephone conversations, and of course at this point the weather went ape, and the mountains socked in, and again the great storms battered McKinley from all directions for 3 more days. Now the accident happened the 26th of June, 71, about 2 in the afternoon. During the storm, the expedition members sledded Dr. Bouillard to the 8,200 foot level, an area of a pressure ridge that was safe enough to land on. So the 29th of June, as the storm began to break, I was there with an aircraft to shoot a landing and pick up the doctor's body. I got several surprises. One was the snow had not set up. It was about 6 feet deep and slushy and soft. And I landed and taxied on about a 15% incline right up to the body. And all of a sudden, the plane slid into this deep hole backwards. The engine still ran. I maintained a small amount of power as I began sliding backwards. The tail disappeared. In the crevasse, which was located directly, I slid over it. It caved in, and the tail of the plane was hanging down in the crevasse at about a 30-degree angle. 6 expedition members, on instruction and on the threat that their heads would be chopped off literally, dug with their snowshoes in front of their skis and tunneled a place for me to taxi forward and to escape further sliding backwards into this tremendous ice hole. The tail of the aircraft was hanging down at a 30-degree tilt. The nose, of course, was up in the air at a 30-degree tilt. I was hung only by the heels of the skis over the lip of this crevasse. Fortunately, we didn't do any damage to the tail section or any other part of the airplane, and with the help of the 6 mountaineers, I was able to pull out of the crevasse, go around it, and head down the glacier. And at this point, I shut the engine off, and all 7 of us spent about 2 hours mashing down a slushy runway for 1,200 feet. And we were considering the various possibilities of loading on the body onto the aircraft when a tremendous wind came up from the southwest. That would be a tailwind since I was headed northeast. And it blew and it threatened to blow the plane away. A tremendous wind. It was blowing slush snow in the air 40 feet. And I elected to take off down in the crosswind without the body. I negotiated to take off barely, and I returned the 2nd of July with Janae of Alaska Mountain Guides. Now, Janae is quite a tremendous performer. he has climbed Mount McKinley 15 individual times, which is more than any individual has ever climbed Mount McKinley. Usually they climb Mount McKinley once and that wipes them out, but sometimes occasionally you get a climber that'll climb McKinley two times. But Janae, as a guide, has successfully climbed Mount McKinley 15 individual times. Now, I might explain that he's a man of small stature, weighs about 155 pounds, has broad wrists and a tremendous set of lungs. His knuckles don't quite drag on the ground. He wears a black beard and has a dark Swiss-type, flashing, Oriental, European-type eyes. But the thing is, he has tremendous endurance, and he's multilingual in six languages of Europe, but he don't necessarily displays polish on a climb. Many of his expeditions I have hauled to the west approach, to the various approaches of McKinley, and some of the world athletes are on these climbs. They're extremely strong, but not necessarily climbers. And the typical conversation would be, this guy gonna guide us? Ha, I'll run him into the snowbank. This little guy gonna show us the way to the top of McKinley? They discuss between themselves. And then the chatter and the banter goes on. But strangely enough, in about the first half mile of the trail, all discrepancies of leadership, of equipment, and of strategy are settled, period, in the first half mile of the trail. Janae carries at least 50% more than the load of the heaviest packer. Furthermore, he breaks trails up the mountain and down. And he's also retained as the cool weather expert for the Air Force and the Army. I'll get back to that later. Let us continue with July 2nd, 1971 at 3 o'clock in the morning. Janae had a 16-man expedition for the west approach of McKinley. In addition, I had three other expeditions ready to go, a total of 47 people to climb various approaches of McKinley. Now, in order that I get the help of Janae, the rope artist, to load the body of Dr. Bouliard at the 8,200-foot level, Muldrow Glacier, I must do one thing, have some strategy. My strategy was to start at 3 o'clock in the morning with Janae, who was the leader of the first expedition, which was to take off for the Mount McKinley range. I successfully landed at the 8,200-foot level with Janae. Now, I took the precaution, since Bouliard was 6'4" and weighed about 235, to use one of the favorite weapons of all Alaska. It's a Super Cub, 150 horsepower, finely tuned, equipped with retractable skis and high-powered radio for communications with my Talkeetna base station. The precaution, in addition to that, was to take a 2x8 clear spruce plank and attach it to the wing struts and also to the tail section of this Super Cub. Since Bouliard was too big to get in the plane, we elected to tie him on the outside of the airplane. Finally, on the Muldrow Glacier, we wrestled Bouliard onto the cradle. That is, this 18-foot 2x8 acted as a cradle, attached to the struts of the Super Cub and also the tail section, and tied outside the airplane in this manner, I was able to effect a successful takeoff And I landed the body at the old mining village strip of Kantishna. And there, I met three very nervous people. Two were mountaineers who had been late on their arrival for the outdoor leadership program. And one was a park ranger, a colored park ranger, who was quite excited that I should have the corpse tied on the outside of the airplane. And he elected to go for help, and I told him to hop to it, and then he could take care of the body and take it back to park headquarters, which they did. Anyway, I loaded the other remaining two mountaineers aboard the plane, and I offloaded them at the 8,200-foot level, picked up Janae, the Alaska mountain guide, and returned to Talkeetna. And 42 hours later, I had distributed 47 mountaineers to their various locations on the south face of McKinley.
How much time do we have?
Let me tell you of an occurrence where Janae was recognized for his talent. Along about this time, the military was in the process of flying a refined aircraft from Whitehorse to Anchorage, direct. It was a turboprop refined aircraft, and it had a crew of five aboard, I think. And inadvertently, they crashed into the top of Mount Sanford, which is off airways a distance of some 20-odd miles off the center line of the airway, Whitehorse, Gulkana area. And I'd heard of the crash, but I knew that they planned to abandon the crash when Colonel Blair, flying a helicopter — Colonel Blair is an old acquaintance of mine from years back, he's made three tours in Alaska and was in the old 10th Rescue, and we worked closely on recovery years ago when he was with 10th Rescue. At any rate, Colonel Blair come by, and I greeted him at our village strip, and he said, "Do you know, we are discontinuing the Mount Sanford crash, our recovery, because it's just too dangerous." We took some of our best troops down there, and in one of their giant helicopters, hopefully they can land on top, or at least hover on top of Mount Sanford, and the various cold weather test members could climb down a rope ladder and effect some kind of a examination of the wreckage and possibly recover injured parties, since the wreckage didn't appear to be too severe. Well, at any rate, the long and the short of the operation with the military on Sanford was that they suffered frostbite, and also the winds are very unfavorable down there, and there was a good chance they would wreck the helicopter while trying to hover at 14,000 feet. At any rate, they gave up the rescue effort, and Colonel Blair said that was it was just too dangerous.